You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Sunday, July 8th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Good evening.
You guys all surviving this heat wave?
I'm not.
Well, oh, no, yeah.
How bad is it in LA?
Southern California's bad.
I died 6 hours ago. I'm a zombie.
Is it bad on the East Coast right now? Because it's
a heat bubble that just recently broke, I think, this past weekend, Saturday. So it was our worst day.
So today the high was 99. Friday was our worst day. Yesterday it was like 105 or 106 where I live, and Friday it was like 109. And there were people reporting that lived in the valley, that lived more inland, like 117.
That's crazy.
Like death numbers.
Oh my gosh.
That's African numbers, yeah.
Well, the thing is, there are people here, at least those who live by the water. So once a month, I meet with my cluster, which is my group of PhD students who are all from Los Angeles, because my program is distributed all over the country. And we meet at our professor's house in Redondo Beach, which is really close to the water. I mean, it's got beach in its name. And we were sweltering in her apartment because she doesn't have air conditioning. Because a lot of people who live by the beach don't have air conditioning in LA. They just never needed it before.
Regularly need it, right?
I don't agree with any situation where you don't have air conditioning.
Well, that's the thing. It's so temperate here. If you live by the beach, it really, even on a hot summer day, doesn't usually get above, I don't know, 80. It does in my neighborhood because I live more inland, but it is a huge bummer for people who just have not adapted to this. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And she was saying, yeah, we're going to install one. As soon as I got home from that meeting, my boyfriend was like, hey, we need to get solar panels. Like, we've been talking about doing solar. We've been talking about making some adjustments as we do this big exterior renovation to our house. But he was like, we need to prioritize this now. I am so afraid that we're going to get blackouts again. Like, I want to make a phone call today. Because in LA, the grid gets, you know, there's too much demand on it.
Yep.
And then we're one of the first neighborhoods to lose it. We're one of the last neighborhoods to get it back.
Tesla has the power walls out now. You can get a couple of those.
Nice. Yeah, but you know what? We were comparing, and like, I don't want to speak too soon because we're just now starting our comparison shopping, but Tesla is not the only company that makes the batteries. A lot of companies make the batteries. They've been doing it for a while, and they have higher ratings, and they're more readily available. So we've been comparison shopping. There's one company that you can go through, like your local Costco, that gives rebates. In Los Angeles, we're lucky because there's a lot of solar companies.
So I was just talking to Steve, and I asked the obvious question, is this the result of global warming? And guess what Steve's answer was?
Maybe.
He probably said, under his breath, yes, of course, but then said, we can't tie any one specific weather event to global warming.
Bob, what do you think?
Yeah, basically.
Well, I'm looking at a popular science article from like this week, and the title is, this week's record-breaking heat has human fingerprints all over it.
There you go.
Yeah, because it's statistical. So, yeah, you can't specifically say this one storm system or this heat wave or whatever was due to global warming. But we know statistically we're going to be seeing more heat waves, getting hotter, more extreme weather events, more powerful storms. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening.
Yeah, soon these things that seem anomalous will no longer be. Like in Los Angeles, we have very predictable seasonal patterns. You know, we don't have traditional winter the way that you guys do in Connecticut. We have something that everybody here calls June gloom. In June, it's usually very overcast. It takes a while for that to burn off, and it's a little chilly outside. And then in July, it starts to warm up. And then by August, September is when it's really hot, and then we go into what is unfortunately called Indian summer. I'm not sure where the origins of that term are, and I'm not sure if that's actually a term that we should be trying to change. But it's often hot up through November here. And so we're starting to feel the depths of summer at the end of June. That's really rare.
And it's not just America sensing these changes. England, I know, I don't know if they're still in their big heat wave, but 90-degree temperatures all throughout England. the past week or so. And
do people
showed,
have AC
like,
there?
They had a picture of a truck, this big, heavy, heavy truck. I don't know what the heck it was lifting. But the pavement below it started to, you know, liquefy to a certain state, and the truck sunk into the pavement.
Oh, my gosh.
Those are the kinds of things that are happening in England with their weather.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Woohoo! Yeah.
And there's nothing that we could do. You know, there's nothing fast and furious we could do to fix this.
No, I think the things are we need to empower ourselves as individuals to do what we can to reduce our contribution to the problem, to reduce our emissions, to reduce our greenhouse gases, to reduce our pollution, our consumption of energy, all that kind of stuff. And then those of us who are in a position that we can, and it's unfortunate that this is not a position everybody finds themselves in, but those of us who are in a position to be able to afford to, we've got to start doing what Steve already did, what I'm hoping to do soon, which is set up a way to get off the grid.
Worse before it gets better.
It's going to get worse. No matter what, it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Enjoy the heat in any way you can. You
know, Hope the power stays on. Cross your fingers.
Well, I have some fun summer good news, I guess.
What is it?
Well, you know, I have two children. I have my son Dylan, who's 5, and my daughter Olivia, who's 2, 2 and a half. And Olivia is now starting to swim better than my son.
Yeah.
Yep. She's more independent. You know, she's just not scared. And Dylan is very cautious in the water. And Olivia is more like I was, where she's just doing it, you know?
Hmm. Well, that's good. The earlier kids learn to swim, the better.
Yeah, Jay, you were swimming really young as a toddler.
He was amazing. He would jump off of a three foot diving board. He's like, what, 2? Jump off.
Yeah, mom said I
and
was
then
2.
He couldn't swim on top of the water, so he would swim underwater and swim to the ladder and then get up and repeat the process. It was incredible.
Yeah. I took to the water. I mean, it was my favorite thing to do. Swimming was like my favorite lifetime thing to do.
That's so funny. My friends have a pool and they have a 2-year-old, and the 2-year-old loves the water. Every time I'm there, he's in the water with me. Every time mom and dad are in the water, 2-year-old's in the water. So they're like, I know, we'll have a swim coach come to the house and teach him, like legitimately teach him how to swim. So they pay this person ungodly amounts of money and he won't touch it while she's in the pool.
Oh, wow.
She just runs around the outside. And so then they're like, maybe she's not the right person. So they hire another one. Same problem. He's just in full-on 2-year-old contrarian mode. Do you have that with Olivia? Is she everything you say yes to, she says no to?
Well, she listens to my wife a lot better than she listens to me. I think it's like a male-female relationship.
She's definitely a willful girl.
Oh, yeah.
And one day Jay is going to have to correct
Steve.
Her.
Did you have to go there?
I definitely think that.
And then I corrected them.
All right, Karen, what's the word?
Ooh, the word this week was recommended by Otilia Neji. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing your last name correctly, from Copenhagen in Denmark. I came across the word etiology, same word, but one of them has an A on it. In connection with pathology and pathophysiology, I was wondering if this word has a broader use, especially in skepticism. After all, it deals with causation and reasoning. So etiology is a word. I always said I was going to start spelling them, and then I completely forgot. Etiology is the American spelling of the word. But of course, the British spelling, and I'm not sure how many other English-speaking countries use it, is A-E-T-I-O-L-O-G-Y. Steve, this is a word that you come across all the time as a neurologist, isn't it?
Yeah. I use it every day. Yeah.
So etiology, as Otilia said, has to do with causes. It has to do with origins. And specifically, you see it in the context of diseases or conditions, right? So etiology is a branch of science, the science of etiology. You can study it, or it's just a word to describe, it's a noun, to describe the cause of something. And when we say the cause of the disease, we can both talk about it. Typically in a medical sense, we are speaking about an individual etiology, but it can also have to do with the epidemiological etiology as well. I hope I didn't just complicate things by saying that. So Steve, like when you have a patient come in and they say, oh, I have this really bad headache, you want to know where's that headache coming from, right?
Yeah, so, and we use the term etiology. This is one of those technical terms that's important because it's actually more specific than the term diagnosis, because mm-hmm. diagnosis is actually a terrible term because it could mean so many different things. So, and I like when I'm talking to medical students, we have to make this very specific distinction. Like when somebody presents with a neurological symptom, a presentation, mm-hmm. like what I tell my students is the first thing you need to figure out is the phenomenology, right? And let's say somebody, their complaint is I'm having difficulty walking, but difficulty walking is not a neurological phenomenon. It's something the patient experiences. So we have to then figure out what the phenomenon is. Is it weakness or visual problems or ataxia, or right, yeah. then there's a specific neurological thing happening. That's the phenomenon.
Well, it could be a then gravitational problem too. Don't forget.
Then if necessary,
yes,
it could be orthopedic. They could have bad knees, right? All those things yeah. can cause difficulty walking. And then, so that's the phenomenology. Then if necessary, you localize it, like where is the problem actually coming from? And then you can talk about etiology, mm-hmm. then, which is what is the specific cause of it. So the patient may complain of difficulty walking. Let's say it's due to weakness. I localize that to whatever, the nerves. And then the etiology is a polyneuropathy. Mm-hmm. Pathophysiology then is deeper than etiology. Etiology is just like, what is the disease? What's the cause of the phenomenon that you're dealing with? Pathophysiology then deals with, like, okay, there's an antibody binding to this protein, which is causing, you know, that's the really specific physiological, biochemical, anatomical things that are happening that are resulting in the natural history of the disease, all of the symptomatology, the diagnostic outcomes, et cetera.
And you'll also hear that referred to as pathogenesis, right? That's also the kind of the start of that, or the source of that, but from a pathological, right. a more specific, I guess you could say, cellular or genetic or perspective. So you will see those words oftentimes compared. A lot of dictionary entries will say, see also pathogenesis, when they talk about etiology. But I could see how a lot of people might get the term etiology confused with a lot of other things like epidemiology or like etymology, or because they seem to have a similar root at the beginning, which is like giving rise to or giving cause to something. So like in talking about the etymology of the word etiology, what we're really talking about is how the word began. That's specific to etymology. Etymology has to do with the development of words themselves. Etiology has to do with the causes of diseases, or at least the causes of kind of medical conditions. I guess it doesn't have to just be diseases, right? It can be syndromes and, you know, really anything, but like a condition, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean etiology.
Etiology, exactly.
If you have a syndrome, it's a pure clinical syndrome that is mm-hmm. just a description of the symptoms and natural history and epidemiology, et cetera, but we have no idea what causes it.
Then yeah, then really, there is no.
You can't really call it an etiology. Like we have things to like, someone has a fever of unknown origin. That's not an etiology. That's just a clinical description of the situation. Mm. So that's why the
actually it's a fever of unknown etiology.
Yeah, it's a fever of right. Or you might say like idiopathic polyneuropathy. That means we don't know what's causing it. You know.
Yeah.
That's what the term idiopathic means.
And it really has to do, etiology has to do with causes. You know, that's really where the root of the word comes from. It's the science of causes. The science of how something came to be, what is responsible for it. All of these roots relate.
Good word.
It's a good word, right? Because it's one of those words that, it's Greek in origin, and it kind of sounds like a lot of other words. And in context, it might not be that easy to figure out exactly what it's referring to. But it's a good vocab word, I think, because you can use it. You don't have to just use it in terms of medicine.
You can use it poetically in any context.
Literarily, for sure.
All right. Thanks, Kara. Mm-hmm. So guys, psychologist, Etzel Cardena, published a review of parapsychology in the journal American Psychologist.
Are we supposed to know who that is?
No.
No.
Okay. Thank you, Evan.
Wait, a review of parapsychology, like a credulous view or just a review of?
No. A totally credulous review. So,
journal? American Psychologist?
American Psychologist, yeah.
Oh, no, that's our flagship journal for the American Psychological Association. That's our accreditation.
Yeah, oh,
that's not some crap journal. That's a legitimate journal.
No, that's like publishing it in Science or Nature.
Or JAMA.
Yeah. Or JAMA, yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yikes.
Yeah, I mean, the psychological journals have a history of having a problem with publishing credulous parapsychology papers and studies. Like BEMS research got published.
But that was a while back.
Yeah, this keeps happening. I mean, it is a complete. It's a summary of the believer position. You know, just sort of maybe updated a little bit and being published in a peer reviewed psychological journal, which is makes it newsworthy. But what I want to talk about is the section of his paper where he talks about the plausibility of ESP. So ESP, you know, being extrasensory perception, the ability to either like read someone's mind or feel the future, right? To use BEM's term, to be able to, for future events to influence current behavior. And, you know, skeptics and scientists hold that ESP or psi phenomena are at the extreme implausible end of the spectrum because, you know, the laws of physics don't really account for them. You know, we have the standard model, right? And while the standard model is not complete, it is one of the most successful scientific theories of all time. It has extreme predictive powers. And what physicists can say with a great deal of confidence is that there probably aren't any particles or forces out there that are operative in the realm of people. You know, like in our everyday lives, things that affect, you know, our functioning. The kinds of forces or particles that would be necessary for ESP to exist.
Right. We would be, they would be very noticed by now, very noticed.
Yeah, you can't have, I mean, you could say, what about like dark energy? Yeah, dark energy is acting at the scale of the universe, and it, you know, you have to make cosmological observations to detect it. But, you know, if you're talking about ESP, if something were operating on that level, physicists should know about it by now. Again, we never say impossible, but it just means, yeah, that's really, really implausible. And then, of course, if you talk about affecting the future, now you're talking about reversing the error of time, the error of causation. That's about as scientifically implausible as something gets, right?
It's so hard for me to even take this conversation seriously.
I know. Yeah,
but I cannot believe that this is like making me really angry.
You're hurt by this. I feel it.
Kara, club, sister.
Yes.
In order to argue that these things are plausible, what do you think he cites?
Oh, that's an easy one.
Oh, I got it, Steve.
I'm opening the article right now so I could tell you.
Two words, right?
He uses the oh yeah quotient.
Nope.
What's
even better than that.
I don't know.
One of Bob's favorite words.
What is it?
Quantum, baby.
Oh!
Quantum
yeah.
I will tell you, what I'm seeing is that there's no pagination specified. It says May 24th, 2018. I don't know if this is actually going to get published in a hard copy.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that matters because it's available online anyway.
Yeah, it's available. Yeah, but this is the advanced online publication.
Yeah,
but it said advanced.
That somebody catches it.
Yeah.
And doesn't allow, I mean, obviously it already passed the reviewers. Okay, what does he cite?
So, quantum mechanics and relativity, right?
No.
So, yeah.
No.
So, this is basically his line of argument, which other people have used before. He says that quantum superposition means.
Of course.
That particles.
Now Bob's upset.
Right. So, the idea that if you have two particles that have entangled properties are separated even by light years, you know, like the one particle is spin up, one is spin down. As soon as one particle interacts with something and declares, it goes from being indeterminate to having a determined property like spin, then that immediately determines the other one's spin. This is Einstein's spooky action at a distance, right?
Right.
He says, this is where he makes the giant leap. Therefore, the universe is non-local, and therefore, non-local phenomena, all non-local phenomena at any scale are plausible. And of course, that's nonsense. As Bob actually quite eloquently points out in his chapter in our book on quantum Roo, that, right? Because Bob, we wrote a whole chapter about this. This in quantum entanglement exists in very fragile experimental setups, right? And there is something called decoherence. Decoherence happens whenever a quantum system interacts with anything else, right? Mm-hmm. It's sometimes referred to as the quote unquote observer effect, but that's a misnomer because there doesn't have to be any consciousness involved. It's just that you're just bouncing off other particles, right? You're interacting with other stuff, and then the decoherence occurs, and then this sort of fragile quantum entanglement goes away. So there just is no quantum entanglement at a macroscopic level or operating at the level of your brain.
And even if there were, you can't exchange information.
Exactly.
It would be a flow random information back and forth. It was the best you could do.
Yeah. So in fact, the very thing that he cites proves that it's not possible because there can't be any exchange of information. And so you can't partially cite a scientific theory, right? You can't say, I'm going to just choose this one tiny little aspect of this scientific theory and ignore all the parts that say that it's impossible and then extrapolate that to the universe from these rarefied special situation and say, therefore, magic is real.
So do you think that this, like, what the bleep do we know phenomenon, do you think that it's, and again, it probably doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things, the outcome is what it is, but this guy, do you think it's more likely that he is just, like, doesn't understand quantum mechanics and that's
there's why? No question that he doesn't understand quantum mechanics.
You don't think it's that he's ignoring the evidence that says that this is obviously impossible argument. It's just
that's a false dichotomy. It's clear that he doesn't get it. It's also clear that he's not listening to people who he should be listening to.
Oh, for sure.
And Sean Carroll, for example, who is I understand, is an actual physicist who's written about this very thing. It's like, if you believe in physics, you know, everything that we know about, you know, the standard model in physics, et cetera, says that this is impossible. And there may be stuff that we don't know, but you would be overturning huge swaths of modern physics, and you don't do that casually.
Right. And I just finished one of his books, From Eternity to Here, and I could authoritatively say that he absolutely believes that you cannot exchange information using entanglement. He specifically addresses that, I was very happy to hear him specifically.
Yeah, so you can't cite entanglement as a mechanism for exchanging information at a distance. You can't do it. He's using it in the vaguest, almost metaphorical sense. It's all interconnected. And then once you basically make that blanket statement about reality based upon quantum mechanics, and then you could make up whatever you want within that space, that's basically what he's doing.
This is what Deepak Chopra does, too, by
the way. Yeah, this is Deepak Chopra level, absolutely. I mean, not as flowery. He's trying to sound scientific. But the thing is, and the lesson here is, do not use scientific theories you do not understand. And part two of that is, you do not understand quantum mechanics. Unless you're one of the dozen or however many people in the world who are actually debating about the proper interpretation of quantum mechanics, if you're at that level, if you're a working theoretical physicist, okay, you're allowed to pretend like you understand quantum mechanics. And I don't know enough to say that you don't. But if you're not one of these people, you don't freaking understand quantum mechanics. Don't try to use it as a premise for an argument. Because if you do, you're going to make a fool of yourself. And the other thing is,
or get published.
If you are not a theoretical physicist with a specialty in quantum mechanics, you should listen to those people who are. And those people who are quantum physicists are telling you that this is not, the ESP is not plausible because of quantum mechanics, period.
Yeah. And this guy, of course, published as a solo author. Yeah. I just clicked through in ProQuest to see other publications of his. And he publishes often in the Journal of Parapsychology, as expected. Yeah. But he's also like heavily published in Psychological Hypnosis. That seems to be something that he writes about quite a lot. But he's also published in really mainstream journals.
Yeah.
It's a bummer. Like, I mean, there are a lot. International Journal of Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis, the Journal of Hypnosis, Psychological Bulletin here, Journal of Abnormal Psychology, because he also writes a lot about dissociative disorders. which I guess makes sense. That, here's the thing. This is a fringy area.
Yeah, but yeah, it sounds like he's flirts with the fringe a lot, clearly.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, understanding science does not necessarily mean that you understand pseudoscience.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
I encounter this every day in my, you know, among my colleagues, whereas within the realm of mainstream medicine, they may understand science very well, but that's really a special case. It's, you know what I mean? It's not, it doesn't include knowledge of the full spectrum of science to pseudoscience. They're just dealing all at one end of the spectrum. It's like the difference between evidence-based medicine and science-based medicine. You know, the evidence-based medicine rules apply just fine if you're living only at the plausible end of the spectrum. But when you go beyond that, you need the rules of science-based medicine, which accounts for pseudoscience, basically. All right, so let me move on. He also tries to make a case for the feeling the future thing. It's really bad. Bob, get a load of this. He said, for instance, events that are still in the future of a slow-moving individual may have already occurred to a faster-moving one. Furthermore, in the special relativity block universe theory of time, past, present, and future coexist simultaneously, although we experience only the present. So he does two things there. So first of all, he completely misunderstands relativity, just like he completely misunderstands quantum mechanics. First of all, you know, he's saying slow moving and fast moving. This is maybe pedantic, but it may sound pedantic, but it actually isn't, because this is where you have to be when you're talking about relativity. It's relatively slow or faster moving, right? There, one person is moving slower or faster relative to the other. And yes, they will experience an event in the future will be subjectively different from one to the other. But the point is, you can't communicate that to the other person, right? Bob, what do you call that? There's, you have the Einstein bubble, where no matter what you do, no matter how you move or what speed you're going at relative, really, or whatever, how, no matter how you mess with time, information can never get from point A to point B at faster than the speed of light.
Well, light cones too, right? This is all about light cones too.
Yeah, this is the light cone. That's what I'm talking about. This is the light cone that no matter what you do, that information could never get from point A to point B, either backwards in time or faster than the speed of light, relative to anyone, to any frame of reference, to any observer, period. So he's just wrong. This does not in any way allow for the possibility of information from the future getting to the past. Again, we can't say it's impossible. You'd have to have some kind of wormhole connecting two spots in time and space. Sure, that's possible. So unless you're making wormholes, in time and space.
Yeah, you need a time-like curve, and he's not making any time-like curve. Sorry.
Yeah, so, but he's like, but it could possibly theoretically exist, therefore it's plausible. No, I don't think you understand what the word plausible means. You know what I mean? You're going to these extremes, and he's misunderstanding
time travel. So therefore, he must have a fully fleshed out version of quantum gravity. Awesome. Let me see that.
Yeah, exactly.
He quotes this book called Quantum Theory and Free Will.
Yeah, that's a whole other segment. I don't even have to get into. He definitely does the.
It's so depressing. I'm looking at this book and it's like published by Springer. It's like this guy is a mainstream physicist who also is sort of credulous about paranormal activity. This is like a whole thing of legitimate scientists doing really illegitimate work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's so many layers to this. I mean, he basically, if you read his paper, he cherry picks and selectively quotes fringe scientists left and right. That's the other thing I was going to point out is like, this one guy, the relativity block universe theory. Okay, so some guy came up with some theory. It's not, this is not mainstream. It's not the theory. You know, so he's just quoting a bunch of cranks to support his crank ideas.
And there are 127 references, and you wonder like how people have a hard time sifting through all the bullshit to find the legitimate science, because this stuff is published in peer-reviewed journals.
Yep.
Right.
Very
but then
bad.
He goes,
very bad.
He goes the whole consciousness, you know, thing is not – he's basically deconstructing materialism. Yeah, he just goes full paranormal, this guy, from beginning to end. But he really polished it up nice, you know, to get into this journal. But it's still, at the end of the day, it's logical fallacy after logical fallacy. Really, really amazing. But yeah, Carrie, you're right. That's the hard part. And already people are citing this and go, look at this. I mean, parapsychology, I guess it's respectable. It's there must be something to it because look at all these references. And this guy's quoting people.
I mean, this is a mainstream journal. Honestly, as I'm reading it, it's like gobbledygook. I'm wondering if the reviewers were just like, I don't understand this.
But it's psychologists peer-reviewing another psychologist about quantum mechanics. They should have given it to a physicist.
Yeah, this is out of their
peer review. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Completely.
Amazing. All right. We're going to go from pseudoscience to science, and then this episode is going to be a little bit of a roller coaster because we're going to be bouncing back and forth a little bit. Jay, you're going to tell us about NASA probing the sun.
Ooh.
Between July 31st and August 19th of this year, 2018, NASA is going to launch its Parker Solar Probe, and it will make history by being the first spacecraft to pass through the sun's outer corona.
Whoa. This is how is it going to survive that?
It's hot.
That's a great question. The details here are amazing, Evan. You read the temperatures and the radiation and everything. They have shielding, of course. I'm going to tell you about it. Again, this is no small feat because, like, what are we talking about temperature-wise?
Corona's over a million.
Yeah, over a million degrees Fahrenheit, 555,000 degrees Celsius. It's really cool. Surprisingly, it's much hotter than the temperature at the sun's surface.
Right? Only about 6,000 Fahrenheit?
9,000 Fahrenheit, 5,500 Celsius. So the probe's heat shields will be subjected to 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 1,300 degrees Celsius, while the probe's payload will only be at what temperature, do you think, guys?
Jay, when you're talking about thousands, millions of degrees, you can just use Celsius. I mean, there's just no point in using Fahrenheit.
We're trying to be inclusive.
Don't want
to
leave anyone out. But you're right. I know. When you get it,
I'm just saying, Fahrenheit is for the temperatures in which we live. That's it. When you're talking about thousands and millions of degrees, there's just no point. I would just use Celsius. Or even Kelvin. Actually, I would use Kelvin.
Yeah, Kelvin is what you're supposed to
Steve,
use.
Steve, I thought you were saying that Celsius is science. Anyway, guess what temperature the payload behind the heat shield will be?
Absolute zero.
I kind of doubt that.
What? Yeah, so I don't know, 400 degrees? No, everything will melt. I don't know.
I don't know either.
Guys, it's only going to be room temperature.
Whoa.
No, it's not.
Room temp.
Yes.
It's going to be like there? Icarus.
No, I'm telling you, it's going to be
25 Celsius.
That's
22, my friend. 22 Celsius.
Yeah, 22 Celsius.
Sorry.
And did you guys know that the word corona in Latin means crown?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because it's on the beer.
Isn't that wonderful? That's so cool. So the probe's going to orbit the sun 24 times over the next 7 years, 7 years from when they launch. And at its closest, it'll be 6 million kilometers or 3.7 million miles from the sun's surface. And this is really great. And I'm really recommending you do this. You got to look this up. Let me tell you what it is and then go look this up. It's going to use Venus's gravity to change its orbit around the sun. So you just have to go see the video of how, as it's going through its 24 orbit cycle, as the planets are going around the sun, you could see how the people that planned this out, they just threaded this needle, this mathematical juggernaut to get this orbit perfect. So what happens is the orbit decays as it goes around the sun, then it comes out to, past the orbit of Venus, and it comes back in, and you could see how the Venus changed its orbit to make it a little bit closer, a little bit closer, and a little bit closer to the final point where the last three orbits of the probe are going to fly as close as 3.8 million miles closest to the sun's surface. That's seven times closer than any other ship, which this is all just amazing that we can do this now.
Wow.
And listen, another cool thing, 3 months after the probe launches, it'll be traveling through the corona at about 700,000 kilometers per hour. That's 435,000 miles per hour.
Jeez.
That's going to be the fastest spacecraft in our solar system.
Really?
I wonder if it'll go through a time warp like they did in Star Trek IV.
We're just breaking all tons of records here, but that's not why we're doing this, even though it's fun. It's going to be able to observe the corona and solar wind up close so we can understand the sun's atmosphere, what do they call it, solar weather, with more precision. So NASA is going to track how the energy and heat traverse through the solar corona. And they'll also try to find answers to why the solar wind accelerates as it moves farther away from the sun, and a lot of other things that they're going to be looking at. Now, you know, with this observation, this can improve our ability to forecast solar wind, its effect on our spacecraft and ground technology, right? You know, like I was saying, like it's actually called space weather, by the way, not solar weather.
Coronal mass ejections, yeah.
Yeah, that could destroy, you know, your cell phone and the power grid and horrible things like that. So we want to know. We'd like to know why there's a huge temperature difference between the surface of the sun and the corona, for example. We actually don't know why. We can't see those details from the Earth.
Big mystery.
The probe's data is going to be the only way that we can answer these significant outstanding questions. And some of these questions have been lingering for decades. I mean, scientists, they wanted to send a mission to the sun since 1958, which also happens to be the year that NASA was created. So this has been on their minds from the very beginning. And it's been, you know, the advances in recent technology. Now, like they're, you know, I guess they've been tracking, like, can we do it? Can we do it? You know, they had, in order to get it close, we have to have certain types of.
I think I can.
But the materials, you know, like it goes back to like the space shuttle, even before that, where they're developing ceramics and materials to figure out how to, you know, how to disperse heat and things like that. That's just the heat shielding. But we also have to worry about radiation shielding too, which is a huge thing here. So I just think, you know, the idea that not only did they fund it, but we're about to have this launch happen. And then very soon after the launch, just months after the launch, we're going to see some real results, even on its first pass. Another cool thing that they said here was that once the ship runs out of fuel, sometime around 2025 or you know, maybe a year after that, the heat shield won't be able to move it. You know, the ship won't be able to position the heat shield to protect the ship. And slowly but surely, the heat shield is going to move out of position and it's going to burn up. We're going to end up with massive 3D images, measurements of the electric and magnetic fields. We're going to track high energy particles. It's really going to revolutionize our understanding of the sun. We're going to have mountains of data coming in every time it passes through.
Will there be any kind of camera on it?
Yeah, they're going to 3D image it.
Can you imagine, like, the you know, think about, I mean, in my lifetime, it was Pluto, right? And I guess Saturn and Jupiter, Cassini, Galileo, what we know those planets to look like now versus how we thought of them before.
Yep.
And we have great solar imaging, but it's all not up close, the same way we had what we thought was good imaging of Jupiter and Saturn. But I mean, think about once that resolution shifts, that's just going to become common knowledge, what the sun looks like.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy.
You know, you see these storms close up on Jupiter and we're getting ideas of what the clouds look like there. It blows you away, you know?
Oh, yeah. Blows my mind. And the sun is so active. Like, it's going to be stunning.
Yep. And that's not the only mission. There's another mission being sent by the European Space Agency. They're sending a solar orbiter, which launches in 2020. And that's going to take detailed images of the sun's poles, which is another area that we don't know much about. And this is by far, I think, my most favorite thing about all of this, is that the cool thing about studying our sun is it gives us a view into every star. It lets us, by studying our sun, we will know the properties of other stars, especially stars that are similar to our own. But it's still just, how does it work? How does the energy transfer? What's happening below the atmosphere that we can't get, you know, crystal clear imagery on? It's going to allow us to develop safer systems. We're going to be able to send people deeper into space, more reliable missions. It's just going to help out in a lot of different ways. So I am dying to see what they come out with.
It's next month. Cool.
Yep.
It's amazing how complex just a collapsed ball of gas could be.
Yeah.
There's a lot of energy there.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. And if we can just use some of those techniques on Earth, like, oh my gosh, it could be so cool.
Kara, they say, you know, don't mess with the sun. You do not mess with the sun.
Don't you go flying there with your wax wings.
I know.
You're not supposed to look in the sun.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to learn too much about fusion itself by doing this, but there's so many other complexities involved in the system that it's going to be amazing.
But no, but really, understanding solar weather is very important.
Yes. Oh, my God, yes. Yeah, I don't want to have our technology thrown back into the 1800s with one coronal mass ejection, man. Another Carrington-level event, we are screwed.
Well, I have a theory that when that spacecraft transits the sun, at that close, aliens are going to find us. I guarantee it. I can guarantee it.
No doubt. Yep.
He can guarantee it.
That'll be our first contact. Our first contact moment. That's right.
Are you going to publish it in the Journal of American Psychology?
I've already submitted my letter.
they've accepted it already.
Actually, when it happens, he'll then retroactively publish it back in time so that
we'll
have predicted it. Yeah. So, Evan, what I don't understand is about your news item is how come the American military doesn't use these bulletproof amulets on every soldier? Why would you send a soldier into combat without making them immune to bullets?
Oh, wow. That's a great question, Steve. And so if you have the power to make amulets that render the wearer bulletproof, then, hey, you're onto something, aren't you? But how do you prove such a claim? Well, what you would do...
That's easy.
What you do, see, is you find someone who will be willing to wear the charm or the amulet. You put it on them, and then you take live rounds and you start firing it right at them. And that actually did happen.
I'm so confused already.
This actually happened. Well, let me explain a little bit in more detail for you, Kara.
Thank you.
This was originally reported in something called The Punch, which is a Nigerian newspaper, I'm told, with questionable credibility. But the BBC saw it fit to pick it up and run with it. And once the BBC did that, it was picked up all over the planet, basically. His name was Chinaka Adezui, a Nigerian self-styled traditional healer and charm maker. Yep, charm is in good luck, with all the equivalent powers of rabbit's feet and horseshoes. That kind of charm. He crafted some charms in which he claimed made the wearer bulletproof. And those words, bulletproof, are in quotes. And in order to prove that the charms were effective, he wore them around his neck. He handed a gun to one of his customers, told the customer to shoot him. The customer, after some reluctance, did fire at him, and he died.
Shot and killed.
Oh, no.
Foisted upon his own petard, as they would say back in the day.
Yep.
So did he think that there were, like, blanks in the gun? Because he handed the guy a gun.
Right. Yeah. Was it a mistake? Is the reporting 100% accurate on this? It's a little sketchy.
Yeah.
The police, the authorities in the area are holding the customer, the one who pulled the trigger, on charges of murder, because I suppose they don't legally have any other means to hold him until I suppose their entire investigation is complete. But this is how it's being reported. And unfortunately, we'd like to say that this is a isolated case, something that's really never happened before, but that's not the case. In fact, earlier this year, just January of 2018, another traditional medicine seller was arrested after a man drank a bullet-repelling liquid and was shot dead.
So how many medallions did he have on him? Like, they cover his whole body?
Yeah, right. And like exactly. So it turns out to be armor of some kind. Unfortunately, what does happen, though, Steve, I read, is that sometimes law enforcement in those regions of the world will not only wear their Kevlar, but they will also wear these charms and, you know, attribute a double layer of protection essentially upon themselves. Mm-hmm. And then if they were shot and they do survive, I would say chances are they're going to credit the charm for having saved them and not the Kevlar. Charms in Nigeria and other African nations are not unusual, unfortunately. There are huge markets for all sorts of charms, magic rings, potions, spells, you name it. If it was in the Dungeons & Dragons monster manual or Dungeon Master's Guide, they're practicing it today.
But, you know, listen, it's no different than believing in homeopathy or believing in chi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every culture has their belief system.
No, you're right. You're right. I mean, fortunately, the world of homeopathy doesn't make claims like you will survive gunshot wounds.
No, they say you'll survive cancer or AIDS. You know, that's saying take this homeopathic, you know, vaccine for AIDS absolutely is the same thing as where this bulletproof, you know, charm.
Yeah.
It's similar.
It's not as dramatic.
Right. Not as sudden, perhaps.
But at least in this case, I mean, there's a little bit of schadenfreude from, you know, being, you know, hoist on your own petard, as you say, Evan. At least it was the healer who got shot. It's like, remember that video of the guy who thought he could make his skin like titanium using his chi? And then he almost chopped his arm off with a knife?
Yep, a martial arts practitioner from the Philippines. So tried to do a stone skin ritual on himself and took this extremely sharp sword, machete-like thing, and gave it his arm a really good whack and cut right down to the bone.
Yeah. Ooh, it's hard to watch.
Oh, it's so hard to watch.
It shows you how delusional people are. I mean, he probably has used a dull knife in the past and thought, you know, that he was actually doing something. And then for this demonstration, somebody gave him a real knife, you know, one with an actual blade, sharp blade. But it's terrible. Just the risks of believing in magic.
That's right. And like you said, Steve, it doesn't just have to come in the forms of charms, potions, and other things. It can be all sorts of nonsense. It comes in many flavors, many varieties, and a lot of them can be fatal.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Yep. Bob, now we're going back to science again now. This is an interesting one. I have to say, this was going to be one of my science or fictions until you sent it to me as a news item.
That'll do it.
Damn. Okay.
this is about spider ballooning.
Yeah, so researchers have finally proven that ballooning spiders can soar vast distances using their webbing and atmospheric electricity. No wind required.
No wind required. So, it's so cool.
Cannot be.
So clearly, Steve, fiction. You would have got Jay, but yeah, not me and Kara.
So this was
especially intriguing to me. I first heard of ballooning spiders when I was a young reader of Charlotte's Web, my favorite book as a youngster. I read it 14 times, I believe. It got me into, so I love spiders, Spider-Man, all sorts of spidery stuff. So spiders, they can point their abdomen in the air, or releasing webbing from their spinnerets, and rise into the air. Spiders have been found all over the planet, on mountains, in the middle of the ocean, almost 5 kilometers high.
Wow.
And then this is how these spiders that balloon, this is how they disperse themselves, and it's quite efficient. Now, I wasn't aware of this, but Darwin himself experienced this on the HMS Beagle when he was on deck Halloween morning, 1832. I think he was hanging some skeleton decorations, but that's only my theory. But when he noticed, he noticed thousands of spiders all over the ship, and with their, you know, with their little silvery silk hanging from them, they had just ballooned onto the ship. Like, look, a ship. Let's rest down here. Not that they exert much energy. So that, of course, is just one of those natural Halloween decorations. If you can get 1,000 spiders for your Halloween party, real ones, you are all set. You don't need to do really anything else. That's fantastic.
I know what to get you, Bob.
Yes. Anywho, Darwin wrote the following in his diary. I caught some of the aeronaut spiders, which must have come at least 60 miles. How inexplicable is the cause which induces these small insects, as it now appears in both hemispheres, to undertake their aerial excursions. So Darwin thought, though, that electricity might be involved, very prescient, since the spider threads he observed seemed to push each other apart from a static charge, like your hair after being touched by a party balloon. So, but for centuries, though, it just seemed too obvious that the wind, of course it's the wind. What else could it possibly be? The wind is pulling on the threads and lifting them into the air.
Most likely candidate.
What else do you really need?
Yep.
Right? So, it's those things that you just never even question. But unless you're looking really closely, which is kind of what science is all about. There was an increasing amount of skepticism, especially, you know, relatively recently. Of course, very observant people made keen observations that it just seemed like the wind seemed less and less likely because sometimes there was clearly not enough wind to lift for some of these spiders. It's like almost no wind at all, and these spiders are taking off. Like, how are they even taking off with a barely perceptible wind? And then, of course, you had large spiders were ballooning, so much so that it was obvious that the wind could not possibly lift these corpulent arachnids. So in 2013, University of Hawaii physicist Peter Gorham, he calculated that it was theoretically possible that spider silk was conducting static electricity, and that could be used to soar through the atmosphere. So we kind of showed that, yeah, this is doable. But it was only recently, however, that Erica Morley, who is a sensory biophysicist, hello, that sounds cool, at the University of Bristol, she was able to prove this in a laboratory setting. Now, Morley used a lab that could replicate the electric field in the atmosphere, which is always there even when we don't see or hear the crackle of lightning. I mean, this is a real thing. The upper atmosphere is positive and the Earth is negative. And the difference between the two is called the atmospheric potential gradient, APG. And who doesn't love a good gradient? Right, Jay? So today it was cloudless in my part of Connecticut, but APG levels were still around probably 100 volts per meter. And during a storm, though, it could be 100 times that amount, 10,000 volts per meter. So this is basically a constant electric circuit that's revolving around the Earth, and the Spider Lab can replicate that with a flick of a switch. So they essentially had some spiders in their lab itching to fly, just wanting to balloon, I'm thinking in my mind. So as soon as they electrified the lab, the spiders did what they do only when they want to go ballooning. They raised their abdomen in the air, and they did what's called tiptoeing. They kind of like alternately lifting some of their legs, kind of like a person on their tiptoes. They only do that when they want to balloon. That's the only time they strike that pose. Now, some of them actually released their silk and took off into the air. And don't forget, there's no wind in this lab. They made sure that there was no wind, and they still took off. And then as they turned the field off, they slowly settled to the ground. So that's pretty damn good evidence in my book. So you may be asking, well, how do they even know? And it's like,
how does this work?
The hairs on their legs, I think they actually observed that they could observe the hairs on their legs raising up in the presence of the field. And that's called trichobothria.
What?
Trichobothria. Sensing.
Trichobothria. Electric fields?
Yeah, your hair, the tricho, right, is hair. And Bothria, I don't know, whatever. I guess it's sensing an electric field with your hair, with your hairs. Like, when your hair stands on end, you could feel that, right? I mean, you could feel that happening. And that's pretty much what they're doing. So it's pretty much a done deal. So what they said was that we don't know yet whether electric fields are required to allow spider ballooning. We do, however, know that they are sufficient, said Morley in a press statement. So they pretty much show that, yeah, this works. And I'm sure they use a combination. You can get up there and you can accelerate pretty quickly with almost no wind using these electric fields. But if you really want to do some major, major league traveling, of course, a nice wind and some thermals are going to help you. So what's going to happen in the future? I think they're probably going to extend their experiments to other ballooners. And there are other ballooners like caterpillars and spider mites. But this made me wonder, of course, could this be used by people in the future?
Well, Spider-Man.
I couldn't help but thinking, yeah, right.
The next Spider-Man movie is going to have this.
Imagine you've got some harness that's attached to some like lightweight mechanism that releases millions of these nanofibers high into the atmosphere. I mean, could you lift yourself up like the house in Pixar's Up? I'm totally riffing here, but I wonder what the physics would say about a human taking advantage of those electrical fields, and what could you lift conceivably? And now I know, of course, spiders are, their weight's negligible, and they produce the thread. But what if you had a million of these little nanofibers that you could create somehow? Could it lift a person? Could you lift a dog? What could you use to taking advantage of that gradient? I don't know, but I'd like to see some of the physics on it.
Yeah, that's cool.
What I like about this news item is it shows our bias for thinking of the world on our level. What I mean? So, obviously physics is the same at the scale of insects and spiders, whatever, but the relative forces are different. And so there are lots of forces which are negligible at our scale, which are important at the insect scale. It's like another one that always intrigues me is water surface tension.
Yeah.
Well, surface tension, it's like insects that could walk on top of the water because of surface tension, but
jumpers that jump all around the surface.
Yeah, exactly. So this is another one. Like, we don't think of electric fields. Like, we see spiders ballooning and we think it's wind because that's what's operative on our scale, but at the spider scale, something more subtle like electric fields is actually important. It's interesting.
Cool.
Yeah, it is.
All right, Kara, finish us off with getting us up to date on this hogweed infestation that we're having.
I love hogweed.
Harry Potter.
And Harry Potter. I love the butterbeer at hogweed. Oh, no, that's not Hogweed.
Hogsmeade, yeah.
So you guys live on the East Coast. So you have more of a risk than I do, at least so far, of coming into contact with an interesting plant called the giant hogweed plant, otherwise known as, ooh, I love this, Heracleum mantegazianum. Yay for my Latin. So this is a phototoxic and noxious weed, and it was actually first introduced to England as an ornamental plant, and then it spread over to other places where people thought, oh, that's so pretty. It's really, really tall. It can grow up to like 2 meters high. It's got these big umbrella flowers that are white and kind of pretty. I mean, it does look like a weed, but it's a very striking weed. It's a completely invasive species. It is not native.
You said it's phototoxic?
Yeah.
That means it gets mad when you take a picture of it?
Yes.
That's exactly what it means. Yeah. That's why it's making rounds in the news. No, we will get to the phototoxicity in a second. But so, yeah, this is not a native plant. And you're seeing a lot of articles coming up in the literature right now. You may see some like kind of public articles or public interest pieces about it popping up in, there's a pretty famous case recently in Virginia, popping up all over New York. It's now been found in 11 states across North America, mostly sticking to the East Coast. And it can actually be really, really dangerous if you're not careful. So I thought it, I thought it was really interesting to talk about this plant's defense strategy. This is how it obviously tries to protect itself from insects and from small animals. But of course, if we human beings, speaking of looking at things from our perspective, if we human beings get mixed up with this plant, we can have a reaction called phytophotodermatitis. And phytophotodermatitis can be pretty gnarly if we're not careful. So it all comes down to a compound inside this plant sap called a furocoumarin. And furocoumarins are these interesting phytotoxic compounds. And the way that they work is when this chemical comes into contact with sunlight, it can actually get into the organism's DNA, and it induces this really strange reaction that causes really severe burns, but it only happens in the presence of sunlight. And the burns can lead to these dark hyperpigmentation areas. So people who have had phytophotodermatitis in the past might have these kind of leftover brown scars that cause that happen from a melanin reaction there. But it can be a really severe, like third-degree burn where you get these massive blisters and the skin sloughs off. There, I was looking at a couple of articles in the literature about like the wound treatment, and it sounds very similar to severe, you know, wound treatment for severe physical burns. Burns from fire. And there was a plant that was found recently in Virginia, I think I mentioned. They were able to sort of trace that back to just it having been an ornamental plant that was planted in somebody's yard. There were a cluster of them, but they think it was an isolated event, so they're not too nervous. But unfortunately, a lot of the ones that have been found in New York recently, they think it's just secondary to the fact that this plant is it spreads really easily because of its seed disbursement. So they're really nervous about the fact that, you know, it could be spreading and people might not know about it because it's not a native plant and we're not really taught much about it. And they might walk up and say, oh my gosh, that's really pretty. And at first they don't notice it because it doesn't really hurt on contact. But then when they're out in the sun, they can have these really severe third degree burns. There, you'll see a lot in the coverage too that it can cause blindness. I'm not saying it doesn't cause blindness. I have no idea. Every article that I found says that that is a potential outcome, but they all also say that they can't find any citations of that in the medical literature. Like studies constantly list blindness, but there are no actual primary sources of blindness, like a blindness event published from contact with this giant hogweed. But still, I mean, I wouldn't risk it. You know, don't go around putting it in your eyes. It's really interesting. I mean, I'm super interested in the toxicity of it. Obviously, I've never experienced it, so I can be interested from a distance. But the cool thing that you may know about is that citrus fruits have furocoumarins in them too. So if you've ever heard of a bartender, like who works with a lot of lemons and limes all day, and then they go outside and they get burns on their hands, that's the same effect. Oh. Have you heard about that happening?
No.
I know. Oh, okay. I've seen it before.
I've heard about bartenders, though.
Yes, that's good. That's good, Bob. But I've seen it before where somebody will get citrus on their skin, and then they won't wash their arms right away. And then when they go out in the sun, they'll get a burn, and they don't know where it came from. It's actually from the furocoumarins that are in the citrus fruit, but it's not as severe a reaction as the hogweed seems to be. But also there does seem to be individual differences between how bad the burns can get. And yeah, they just say if you do come in contact with this plant, just make sure you wash it as soon as possible, because if you can get the sap off of you before it like invades your DNA, before it's exposed to the sun, before it invades your DNA, you may be okay. And even if you can't, just make sure that you really avoid sun exposure for the next several days.
Yeah. It's a huge plant. It grows up to 15 feet tall.
It's beautiful too. I mean, it's a weed, but it's pretty.
But it sounds cool looking weed. It was originally planted for decorative purposes.
Yeah, because it's pretty. I mean, it is weed-like, but they're big, beautiful white flowers that almost look like umbrellas, and they're well over your head. And so, you know, in a lot of the good science coverage, they're kind of like, don't freak out. Like, obviously, it can have this bad outcome, and we need to be aware of it. But most people aren't going to accidentally walk through giant hogweed.
Yeah.
They're going to be like, whoa, huge. That's a big, crazy plant.
Right.
But the problem is you don't want to go, I did this so many times when I was in the Amazon rainforest, is I would walk up to something. You know, I was out with my friends who are all entomologists, thank goodness. And I would walk up to, I'd be like, what a pretty caterpillar. And I'd go to touch it. And they'd be like, don't touch it, don't touch it. There were so many times when I was attracted to these really bright things in the
Look
rainforest.
Look at the pretty jellyfish.
Yeah, and I wanted to get near it. And they were like, no, you're going to regret
it. I'm petting a jellyfish.
It. Yeah. So that would be my concern with this, is that somebody would be like, isn't this pretty? And like, grab it.
It has been seen in 25 towns in Connecticut, pretty much in every county.
So you guys have a much bigger risk. Keep an eye out for it, though. Maybe take a picture. And I know that in a lot of these places, there's probably an organization, I don't know if it's public health or if it's the park services or whatever, who want to know about this. So you might be able to Google in your home county a place where you can report sightings.
Yeah, because they will control it. Connecticut has a invasive plant working group, and they're very good, actually. They're very aggressive, because you have to be. The problem is that people bring in plants to plant in their yard, and they have no idea about their invasive properties, you know, that they can spread and get out of control so easily.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, I think historically we just always thought so much about what things look like. That's why they have the name ornamentals. And I think there's a movement now, but it hasn't caught on as much as I would like to see it catch on, especially here in California, where we have such an issue with drought and we have such an issue with fires that, you know, we've been planning our exterior renovation. I mentioned it earlier. And we hired a landscape architect who specializes in native plants. Because if you really just dig deep, you can find so many beautiful plants that naturally grow in your neighborhood or in your local community. And, you know, if you just go about it the right way, you can plant a really gorgeous yard that's all native, and that's going to be good for the wildlife. It's going to be good for the bees. It's going to be good for the butterflies, all the insect populations. The more you can keep native materials in your yard, the kind of healthier it is for the ecosystem anyway.
All right. Thanks, Kara. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Last week, I played this noisy. What is that?
It's the Enterprise transporting a circular saw as it's running.
Yeah, That's funny.
That's fun, but not correct.
No, crap.
Anybody else?
Some spinning mechanism.
All right, so
it definitely sounds mechanical. It definitely sounds like something spinning very fast. I think those are the only two things I could say.
JG wrote in. He said, "Hi, Jay. I know I'm probably wrong, but I imagine it's what the LHC sounds like when switched on." And I love that. Yes, I agree. I hope the LHC sounds like epic and deep and huge. It would be fun if it made like that kind of noise, though. I had someone named Brett Erickson write in. He says it's a CNC machine shaping brass or some metal.
Oh, although it does kind of sound like a CNC. A
little bit.
What does CNC stand for?
It's like one of those machines that can do really precise cuts, almost like a laser cutter.
Oh, it is like a laser cutter.
Yeah, you put it in like your thing and they'll cut metal for you.
Cut letters out and stuff, yeah.
Oddly, no winner last week, guys.
No winner?
Oh, really?
No winner. No one. And I don't know. It's funny how I just don't – my perception is very skewed. I think I hear so many noises that I've kind of gotten good at this. But guys, come on. Think about it. It's an electric motor starting.
Okay.
Yes.
That's okay. It.
Listen again.
Wow.
Yeah.
Does it slow down a lot?
Electric motor of what?
It's an electric motor soft starting. I'm not exactly sure what machine it was.
But yeah, that would make a big difference.
It's a small motor. I mean, I've heard really big ones turn on and they, you know, it's like very different size wise. Like it's not that big of a motor.
Hmm.
It probably would power the CNC engine is, I think, if I'm correct, it's a lot smaller than this, the motor that it would use to do whatever it's doing. But this is like, you know, a really, you know, it's like a heavy, heavy part that's getting spun up to speed.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah. I love noises like that. So,
yeah, it's a really cool sound.
It's so confusing. Do electric cars have motors? Cause they do not sound like that.
Yeah. But it's not that kind of motor. It's a different kind of engine. The way that's like,
cause my car doesn't sound like anything.
Yeah. It's very
different. Your car is a black box, Kara. Okay.
It is a black box.
It runs on positive vibrations.
It's wires and hamsters.
When you open it up, there's just a picture of an arrow moving forward.
There's a photocopy of a motor.
Remember that?
That's great.
I'm curious. If any listener knows what we're talking about, email us. I'm curious to see. It is from an episode long ago.
Oh, yes.
So I had a new noisy sent in this week, and this was sent in by a listener named Dave Weldon. Thank you, Dave, for sending it in. Here is the noisy.
That's weird.
That is weird.
Whoa.
It's weird, yes.
It's like a mosquito rave.
Yeah. All right. I could say something. I don't know how hard this one's going to be. I mean, I've never heard it before. And I got to tell you, I've never even heard of the thing that made the noise before. But then when I saw it, I'm like, oh, yeah. Okay. I can see that making that noise. All right. Then if you think you know what the hell that is this week, or if you want to psychically talk to us while we're at Nexus, email me a cool noisy you heard or make your guess at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. We're going to do one email. This one comes from Gareth from Cape Town, South Africa.
Cape Town.
Gareth writes. Gareth writes, "I thought this may be an interesting topic to discuss on the show as I value your ability to research controversial topics. The limited research I was able to do about so-called biodegradable plastics is that the vendors, of course, claim it is the answer to all our plastic woes. But an article on the HuffPo seems to indicate that, as usual, it's more complicated. Looking forward to hearing your take on this topic." So what do you guys know about bioplastics?
Quite a bit.
Oh, boy.
You do? Yeah,
tell me what you know.
What do you know? Well, they're bio, you know.
Yes, meaning biodegradable?
These are plastics that are made out of something that a plant has produced, as opposed to them being oil-based.
Yeah.
Right, non-petroleum based.
Yeah. And the hope here is that, you know, we have an unlimited source and that they're biodegradable, like something else can eat the plastic. You know, you put it in a landfill and something can eat it.
Yeah, so but the key is not just that we're making plastics out of renewable plant-based products rather than petroleum, which is good, but also that it doesn't hang around in the environment forever, you know, because petroleum-based plastics don't ever completely break down or get absorbed into the environment. They just break down into smaller and smaller pieces, right? We talked about this on the show, and they just sort of are just gunking up the environment. So the idea about bioplastics is that they would be more biodegradable. But as Gareth says, looking into this a little bit further, it's just more complicated than that. There are different grades of bioplastics. There's degradable, biodegradable, and compostable. And then there's also what's called durable. So durable bioplastics are like plastic. They don't break down. You're just sourcing it differently, but they're still not going to biodegrade. So, and that's degradable is really another term for durable. You know, they can degrade like other plastics do, but they don't biodegrade. Biodegrade means that they will break down. They won't just break into smaller and smaller pieces in the environment. However, being biodegradable doesn't mean that they necessarily will, you know, in the environment at large, or that will happen quickly. And then compostable means that if you put it in compost, it will break down like anything that's compostable. But the trick there is that they may have a temperature requirement, and some of them will only break down in like industrial level composting equipment, not in your backyard compost. Mm-hmm. So that might be misleading to people if you say this is compostable. It's like, okay, but what kind of compost are we talking about? So it's not necessary. Just saying it's bioplastic is not necessarily any better than any other plastic. We need to know how biodegradable or compostable it is. You have to get that extra layer of information. But at least there's the potential for these plastics to break down, as long as they're transparent, right? Meaning that as long as when you buy it, you know what you're supposed to do with it, right? You want people putting technically compostable plastic in their backyard compost heap, even when it's not going to break down because it's not going to get hot enough, for example. So that you still need to discard them properly. And some of them can be recycled, which is still apparently resource effective. Again, depends on the individual. So it depends on the type of plastic. So the bottom line is, it could be a good idea, but it's not a panacea, and you need to know what kind of bioplastic you're dealing with to make sure that you deal with it properly.
Yep, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Did you guys read about this inventor who wants to see... Steve, do you compost at your house?
Yes.
You do? Okay, so I think you'll love this. This inventor who developed a sticker for fruit that is actually... like soap-based. So when you go to wash the fruit, you don't have to use external stuff because the sticker itself dissolves over the fruit and has a little bit of soap in it.
Perfect.
Isn't that amazing?
That's cool. You
know, and like the most simple thing ever, that why isn't that the case? Because I talk to people all the time who compost and they're like, oh, I always have those stupid stickers in my compost pile.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. You could digest those stickers.
Yeah, but do you want to? I don't put them in my smoothies.
They're high in fiber.
I peel them off and throw them out.
So do I. Well, but can you imagine if you didn't ever have to do that again?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what most people do. But for whatever reason, when you compost, if it's something that you wouldn't eat the skin of anyway, you probably don't remember to.
Like a banana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just throw it in the compost heap. And then
that's
you have these stupid stickers.
Yes, that's correct.
Good point. Good point.
So, but imagine if it were washable.
Compostable. Yeah, at least or compostable fruit stickers, absolutely.
Yeah, they break down. Right? Yeah, break down.
Such a silly thing that they're not.
I know.
Okay, let's go on with my new updated science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Updated. What's that?
Yeah.
If we don't like it, we don't like it.
It means I replaced the item that Bob sent me. So here's the problem is that I prepped this for 3 days ago, but we had to delay it because Jay didn't have internet.
Wow.
And Well, it's Sunday's tough because no, there's really no news items on Saturday and Sunday. So any news item is going to be at least 2 days old, if not 3 days old, which means there'll be a lot more time for it to be out there.
I see.
Right. Okay. And so Bob picked it as a freaking news item. All right. Well, we'll see if you guys have heard of these over the weekend. You ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Item number one. A new report concludes that 85% of asteroids in the inner solar system derive from a single primordial planet. Item number two. A new analysis of an Australopithecus afarensis indicate that unlike the adults, children retained a grasping toe used for climbing. And item number three, a new analysis finds that the first dogs in the Americas came from North Asia, but were almost completely wiped out by European breeds when they were introduced. Evan, go first.
85% of the asteroids in the inner solar system derive from a single primordial planet. Okay, well, it would be helpful to know roughly how many asteroids there are in the inner solar system.
There are seven.
Does the asteroid belt count as inner solar system?
Yes.
It does. All right. A single primordial planet. The thought in my head is that this would be probably larger than any of the other four planets, and that the asteroid belt is beyond that, and that's where a lot of them are. Might lend to there being a larger planet somewhere out there as you head towards Jupiter, but maybe not. I don't know about this one. I don't know. It could be fiction. The next one, the Australopithecus.
Afarensis.
Afarensis, thank you. Australopithecus afarensis. Unlike the adults, children retained a grasping toe used for climbing. Retained. So what happened to it as the children became adults? Does it body reabsorb it or something? Or did it fall off? What? Children retained a grasping toe used for climbing. I don't know. Maybe I'll have more luck figuring out the third one. The first dogs in the Americas came from North Asia, but were almost completely wiped out by European breeds when they were introduced. Well, I would imagine the dogs came with the people, and the people from Asia were first, from North Asia, to the Americas, as best as we understand it. So sure, the dogs would have come in with the people, and then almost completely wiped out by the European breeds. Yeah, I mean, because again, the people came in and did that as well, unfortunately. So as the people go, as the dogs go, I think that one's going to turn out to be science. I'll say 85% of the asteroids, because I don't think you would have had to have a planet that would have been bigger than all models indicate, that wouldn't have been that close to the sun. So that's what I'm saying. Fiction.
Okay. Jay?
All right. First one. The report concludes there's 85% of the asteroids in the inner solar system derived from a single primordial planet. So what happened to the planet? Now, if this is true, this absolutely proves that aliens entered our solar system. I mean, Kara, come on. You know it. Everybody knows
it. Yeah.
Or that tidal forces exist.
That's true. Or a tidal wave in outer space. Now, that would be scary.
Ooh, space wave.
Sure, then what happened in one planet, and how would they even know, and blah, 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 science, blah, blah. Okay.
Silly scientists.
Keep it up, Jay. You'll get published in a peer-reviewed journal soon
That's
enough.
That's right. I know. This is good stuff. Anyway, I'm going to leave that right where I left it. It's at the blah, blah phase, and we're going on to the next one. A new analysis of the Australopithecus afarensis indicate that unlike the adults, children retained a grasping toe. Now, I know people with grasping toes. I'm not kidding. I do.
I know.
I don't think they mean like you could pick up a piece of paper. They mean you could like climb in a tree.
I reiterate, I know people with grasping toes. So this study, they don't know the latest, okay? Because I've got like, I can give them like basically a skeleton of someone that lived like this decade. Anyway, yeah, that's cool. I don't see any reason to doubt that. And the last one, the new analysis finds that the first dogs in America came from North Asia, but were almost completely wiped out by European breeds when they were introduced. Well, I kind of agree with what Evan said, that they would come with the people. But then what happened with Dances with Wolves, Evan? Don't you think dogs came from that movie?
Dogs came from Dances with Wolves.
Yeah, like that explains it, right? That dog was like dog... patient zero with dogs. Like that guy found a friendly
wolf. Okay.
And then soon after, you know, poodles and you know, all sorts of dogs spilled out from that relationship. No?
Soon after, yes.
I don't know.
It's a Reader's Digest version of Dog Evolution.
Thanks for the help, Ev. But okay,
yes, absolutely correct, 100%.
I'm not disagreeing with Evan on that. I think that one could be science. I think the Australopithecus one is probably science. The grasping toe, very useful. And I don't buy this first one with a single planet. It's not enough matter in a single planet to do all that. So I'd say that one is the fiction.
Thanks, Jay. I like not being alone in science or fiction.
Good. Me too.
Okay, Bob.
Me too.
All right, I'll start with three. The dog one, yeah, it there's nothing here that's red flaggy at all. I would love to, if it's true, I'd love to see, it says almost completely wiped out. What are examples of some of the North Asian dogs that weren't wiped out? So that one makes sense. Australopithecus efferensis, that makes sense too. You know, it's just like, hey, if this bipedal walking all the time doesn't work out, we could still get back in the trees. Sounds like a useful fallback. And also, I mean, couldn't they use it to like hold on to the hirsute mommy and daddy and kind of like hang on to their parents? I just, you know, grab that hair instead of a tree. Probably could come, you know, be useful for the early weaning years. So number one, yeah, I guess I got to agree with everybody. It just seems like there's not enough. I mean, it's not the number of asteroids that matter. It's the mass. And I mean, there could be, you know, a million low mass or 1,000 high mass. So the number is kind of irrelevant. But I think I don't know the mass of the solar system of the asteroids between Mars and Jupiter. But I would think it's got to be more than just one planet. Even a super, you know, maybe even more than a super Earth. So probably, I don't know how many, but more than one. So yeah, I'll say that one's fiction too.
And Kara.
I mean, you think I'm going to go it alone?
I'm just going to agree with the guys.
I guess I'm assuming that the guys are all correct, and that's why I'm going with them. So Steve, my question, as I say, number one is the fiction, is how does a primordial planet explode into 1,000 little pieces? Does it collide with another primordial planet?
We'll get back to that.
Okay.
This is Alpha Centauri 5.
Because I would think it would maintain a moon-like status. Like it would be somewhere in orbit and just pieces of it would have chipped off over all the years to become the asteroids. The idea that it would completely disintegrate
into
asteroids.
All right, let's get to
this. Okay.
Let's start with number three.
Oh, boy.
Good stuff.
A new analysis finds that the first dogs in the Americas came from North Asia but were almost completely wiped out by European breeds when they were introduced. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yes, of course.
Yes, they just did genetic analysis on the dogs and found that there was, and also they have remains from the Americas. And yes, so the dogs were definitely not domesticated in the Americas. They were brought to the Americas. And as you say, Kara, there were two migrations. One from North Asia with the Native Americans, the soon-to-be Native Americans, and then one later with European people. And the European breeds predominate, you know, almost completely wiped out. I guess it says almost because there are trace, you know, remains.
Oh, so that's almost some, like Neanderthal or something, not like yeah, no breeds.
Right, yeah, exactly. There's no breeds. It's just that there's some genetic information that's in existing breeds from the North Asian migration. So, yeah, I said few modern dogs have any trace of these ancient lineages, they say. So, yeah, we're good at wiping out stuff.
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's go back to number one. A new report concludes that 85% of the asteroids in the inner solar system derive from a single primordial planet. You guys all think this one is the fiction, and it was almost painful listening to you rationalize why this is the... Do you know what percentage the mass of the entire asteroid belt is what?
Yes.
What do you mean? Is what percentage of the whole solar system?
Oh, no, just give me a number. Give me
a
percentage
no
of what?
27.
Let's
42.
What? How would it relate to the mass of the moon, let's say? Is it less than the moon?
Our
larger
moon?
Than the moon? Yeah.
The entire asteroid belt?
Yeah.
It's got to
be more.
Steve.
More. It's got to be more.
Has to be more.
4% of the mass of the moon.
What? What? What?
That's a surprise.
Exactly. Oh, so that totally could come from a single part. Crap. Did you sweep us?
4%. I'm surprised that you guys all thought that it would be there's asteroids would be so huge. I thought you guys.
I just feel
that.
Like it's always it's in the news that there's a massive asteroid.
The ring is
by.
So it's so yeah, far out this, there, but the, I know it's not
compared to a moon. They're tiny.
But this one, like Jupiter's moons, are some of them are tiny.
This one is the fiction, though.
Aha!
So we win.
Good. We win.
Yes,
we win despite
right for the
our
wrong reason. Yeah.
Reasoning.
But we should be ashamed.
But you should be ashamed.
I'm
of your
not
victory.
Ashamed. I win.
So
I am 4%. I did not know it was that low. That is crazy.
Now the real item is that 85% of the 200,000 asteroids in the inner asteroid belt probably came from 5 or 6 ancient minor planets.
Oh, those must be really small planets.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they could have been. Plus, there's probably a lot of ejections going on, too.
Yeah, but also, like, Kara was asking, how would the asteroids come from? Because there was chaos in the early solar system.
It's
things
primordial.
Were crashing into each other.
Yeah, I didn't really see that word.
Breaking apart. Yeah, breaking apart.
There's a period during the evolution of our solar system that's called heavy bombardment.
Oh, I love the heavy bombardment.
Lots of shit happening. Cool.
So we swept you, Steve.
You did. As painful as it was, you did. But yeah, so there are a lot of the asteroids. This is just like one part of the asteroid belt. It comes from about 5 or 6 different ancient minor planets. So I just exaggerated that into
And it's 4% the mass of the moon?
Yeah, all the entire asteroid belt is only 4% the mass of the moon.
That's amazing.
That's crazy trivia right there.
Yeah.
That's cool. But our moon's a pretty decent size, right?
We have one of the larger moons out there.
We do. Yeah.
Well,
so big that you can consider the moon Earth system as a binary.
Yeah.
Planet. That's cool.
I think comparatively we have the largest moon based on the
sure.
size of our planet.
I think Pluto and
Pluto may have one. Yeah. One of the five.
Charon. Our moon is bigger than the dwarf planets. Mm. Right?
Sure is. Those moons around Mars are pretty small.
Oh, how big tiny. Is how they're big captured are some of Jupiter's probably. Moons compared to like?
Well, yeah, Jupiter has
Mars, but Jupiter's
the biggest Jupiter's moon, really Ganymede. Big. I think they're still considering Ganymede the biggest moon.
Yeah, but compared to Jupiter, I mean,
that's true. Compared to Jupiter, but what about
so
compared
small.
To our moon?
It might be.
It's larger. Big. Oh yeah, Ganymede's like bigger. Ganymede's the
but
biggest
is it
moon
like
in the solar
twice
system.
The size or
and Titan.
Titan is very big.
And Callisto, but
it's oh no, it's, Ganymede's only 2/3. Oh, it's 2/3 the size of Mars. Sorry, it's larger than Mercury.
How big is Ganymede?
Yeah, Ganymede's like twice as big as the moon.
Twice as big as the moon. Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, you're right. Compared to Jupiter, it looks like a tiny little. I mean, you can see
Ganymede
it through your telescope, which is cool. But
Ganymede is 2/3 the size of Mars.
Yeah,
twice the mass.
It's almost as big as Mars.
8% larger than Mercury. Yeah, it would definitely be a planet.
Yeah,
oh, for sure.
Oh yeah.
If it weren't around Jupiter.
All right. This means that a new analysis of an Australopithecus afarensis indicate that, unlike the adults, children retained a grasping toe used for climbing is science. This is
That's
very
cool.
interesting. Yeah. So this specimen is a toddler, like a 3-year-old Australopithecus afarensis. And it's a very good specimen and it has a really well preserved foot, which is very rare.
They're deriving this from one sample?
Yes.
They do that a lot with
the Takika Ethiopia specimen. 3.32 million-year-old juvenile foot of A. afarensis. So one of the foot bones has an ape-like configuration, which is consistent with, you know, the big toe going out to the side, you know, rather than forward. So it would be in a position where it could be used for grasping. So what does that mean? You know, Bob brought up a couple possibilities. It could be used primarily for holding on to the mommy or the daddy when you're riding on their back and they're carrying you around, right? It could also be that they could get into trees to get inaccessible food, otherwise inaccessible food. So clearly we're seeing a transition, you know, from an arboreal existence to a terrestrial bipedal existence. Although adult A. afarensis are fully upright and bipedal, this suggests that the kids weren't and that then they're, you know, we don't have a lot of, you know, of the hominid species. We don't have good ontogeny, right? So in other words, we don't get specimens of all different ages to see how they change and morph as they mature.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there are a lot of species where anatomical structures actually, you know, significantly change as they get older, right? Adults are not just big kids, right? Kids are not just tiny adults. They're actually, their body proportions and some shapes can be different. And sure. So this is more extreme, of course, than anything in humans, but it makes sense. They were, you know, this is pretty soon after transitioning out of the trees. And so they retained from, you know, their ancestors a more of a grasping. You know, and Evan, it doesn't fall off. It just, you know, just repositioned itself.
He's like, I didn't mean it.
I was tongue in cheek. Gotcha.
It definitely, you know, we have this.
What does it do, Steve?
I think it just moves into the forward position as they mature. Mm-hmm.
We have this really great dinosaur exhibit at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County that shows, I might have mentioned this on the show before, it's a T-Rex growth exhibit. And there's like a small, young juvenile T-Rex, an older juvenile, and then an adult. And it talks about the history of paleontology and how historically they might have been thought to be different theropod species, but then once you amass enough of that fossil evidence, then you can start to say, oh, this is actually a growth period of the same species, which is super cool.
And there are some that's very common in dinosaurs. They can exhibit pretty extreme changes in morphology with age, and there are still some species we've talked about on the show, Triceratops versus Torosaurus. There's controversy over whether a Torosaurus or just older Triceratops, or if they're actually different species. And I don't know that that's been resolved completely yet. But yeah, more specimens, obviously, if there's a continuous gradation from one to the other, then you could say, okay, it's probably the same species.
Yeah. And we have lots of T-Rex specimens now. Yeah. But, you know, back in the day, we didn't even know dinosaurs existed.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
All right, guys. Well, you backed into that one this week, but I guess I'll give it to
you. Go team! Awesome.
I led the backing.
We should do the old news items more often.
Yeah. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Eddie, there's no such thing as a psychic. People believe my fol-de-rol because I wear a black tuxedo. We're in showbiz. It's all about razzle dazzle appearances. If you look good and you talk well, people will believe anything. Mm-hmm. Remember that movie?
Razzle Dazzle. No, what's that from?
Ed Wood.
Ed Wood. That was Criswell, portrayed by Jeffrey Jones in the movie Ed Wood. It's a good line.
Yeah.
It's a good line. I like when movies give a little poke at, you know, psychics and other paranormal crazy stuff like that.
I still have not seen that movie.
It's a good movie.
It's so good. Oh, gosh. It's one of my favorites.
I know it's good. Just haven't seen it, but I will.
That's worth the same.
We'll watch it together. I hope so. I hope we'll watch it together, Bob.
All right, guys. Well, as this show goes up, we'll all be at Nexus.
Yes.
So we'll
hope we're having fun.
we'll see you guys in a few days.
We're going to be streaming a lot of awesome premium content to our patrons while we're at Nexus, and that content will also be available to them after Nexus. You know, we'll post all of it.
Excelente.
And if you would like to become a patron of the SGU to help us do what we do, you just go to www.patreon.com/skepticsguide.
All right, guys. Thanks again for joining me.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Sure, man.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Huzzah! Told you.
Yes.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.